Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
give a little bit of inspiration with this, and I'm reading a story that says why other people matter, and in order to have a good life and be happy, what are the things that really count? And if you have any study of positive psychology, and this is really up and coming today, like the psychology of eating and the psychology of family dynamics, a Harvard study followed 268 sophomores from the 1930s to the early 1940s over the course of their adult lives and showed that the single most important predictor of successful aging, defined by physical and mental health and satisfaction with life at age 75, wasn't cholesterol, wasn't a treadmill endurance or intelligence. It was having close relationships. And one of the things is, so if the only things that really matter in your life are your relationships to other people, as a quote, then if vaccines could potentially damage your mental function and your ability to focus and concentrate and your ability to connect with another human being, that would really cause some kind of disaster in the individual and all the people in the family, which would end up to be, you know, you would not have as happy a life if that is your goal. Okay, those are my thoughts.
Wow, and some really interesting insights there, Debbie. I mean, human beings, I think, are on the whole, of course, we're all individual and different, but on the whole, we are social animals, and we need the interaction with people. You know, it's an interesting point. When I moved out here to Asheville a year ago, I had very few contacts here in the immediate area. I knew and still know of those maybe three or four people in the immediate area. And consider my connections with those people all the more important because they were, you know, my good friends are all back in central North Carolina where I had moved from, or many of them. It's really an important thing to have that contact, even if it's just a few really close friends, as I feel like a large part of my own personal social network consists of, as opposed to many layers of different levels of closeness or superficiality. So I can certainly relate to that personally, and seems to make sense on the sort of the common sense level as well as the formal research level there. Well, let me pull it over then.
So if you're talking about vaccines and the potential outcome could be autism, where the individual has mental developmental dysfunction and is not able to communicate, that would reduce the ability of people's fully functioning communication and personal relationships. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's a very broad view, but if vaccines have the potential to damage in that way, then, you know, you're not going to be happy in the end. Okay, go ahead to your next topic, if you like.
Sure, but clearly, yeah. I mean, and I'm glad you clarified the point, because the point here is that the ability to create and maintain and nurture relationships is largely dependent on the ability to communicate interactively And yes, vaccine damage often does directly affect that ability, communication skills, social skills. So clearly, a very much a potential long-term consequence, and not one that I've heard others specifically refer to. So the more recent email comes from Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, a medical doctor who, in my opinion, is probably one of the most most educated and in her case, self-educated about the vaccine issue. She has spent, I'm sure, thousands of hours researching the medical literature and law as well on vaccine issues, and she's quite the expert, in my opinion, on the topic. Sherry has put together something that she calls a vaccine research library, where she has collected, I think at this point, something on the order of 5,000 peer-reviewed published research articles from all over the world. It's an ongoing project, so the number of articles is constantly growing. Articles that show problems with vaccines. You know, there's not the occasional article here or there that, in the rare instances when it does show up somewhere in mainstream media or mainstream circle, it immediately gets batted down as a bad study because it came up with the wrong conclusion. There are thousands of published medical studies showing problems with vaccines. And Sherry has taken on the project and goal of pulling that information together in one place, and anyone can go to the website where she has that. I don't have the web address in front of me, but if you plug the words vaccine research library into an internet search engine, it will probably pull it right up at the top of the list. And Sherry's name is spelled Sherri, 10, like the number 10, T-E-N, and then penny, all one word, like the coin, Tenpenny, Sherry Tenpenny. So if you plug in Vaccine Research Library, if that doesn't pull it up, put in Sherry's name, Sherry Tenpenny. That'll pull it up for sure. But here's information for her. Now, Sherry, in this ongoing collection of published medical studies, has what she calls the Scream of the Week, where she finds a study which has some just particularly strong or outrageous or striking concern that's brought to light in yet another study about vaccines. So this one's going to be posted, if it hasn't been already, as her Scream of the Week for the Vaccine Research Library. Dated May 15th, 2013, studies titled Investigating Viruses in Cells Used to Make Vaccines and Evaluating the Potential Threat Posed by Transmission of Viruses to Humans. So here's, I'm just going to read, I guess this is perhaps a summary of the article or an excerpt from the article, not sure, but I'll just go ahead and read this and let you hear what it says. Detection of latent viruses in cell substrates for vaccine safety. The urgent demand for vaccines against emerging diseases. Now, I got to stop right there. I don't watch a lot of mainstream news, so maybe I just missed the report on this. But I just haven't seen an urgent demand for vaccines against emerging diseases, at least not from the perspective of what's going on in the world. But maybe this is a reference to something in the third world or something I've missed somewhere. But anyway, let me continue. The urgent demand for vaccines against emerging diseases has necessitated the use of novel cell substrates. These include tumorigenic cells for influenza virus vaccines, and it names the particular cells, tumor-derived cells, such as, and it names some other specific cells, one for an HIV vaccine. The use of tumorigenic and tumor-derived cells is a major safety concern due to the potential presence of viruses such as retroviruses and oncogenic DNA viruses that could be associated with tumorigenicity. Now, I'm not a medical doctor, and I don't have a medical background, but we're talking about potential cancer-causing agents here. This is the underlying message. They're saying there's a safety issue with the techniques being used to develop vaccines, to manufacture vaccines, in that you may have viruses that can cause cancer. That's really what this is saying. Therefore, detection of persistent latent DNA viruses and endogenous retroviruses in the vaccine cell substrates is important for vaccine safety, particularly in the development of live viral vaccines where there are no or minimal virus inactivation and removal steps during vaccine manufacturing. Let me read this again. Particularly in the development of live viral vaccines, where there are no steps during the manufacturing process for minimal virus inactivation and removal. So here's a comment at the end, and I believe this is probably Sherry's comment. Maybe this will help clarify some of the language here. The government knows there are stray viruses in the vaccines that can cause cancer, and there are no standard steps in place during the manufacturing process to remove them. Therefore, every vaccine injected into a human body is a potential hand grenade, landing on the immune system to cause destruction, including cancer. Cigarettes come with a warning label because they're known to cause more than 24 different smoking-related diseases, including cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, and 10 different forms of cancer. Vaccines should come with the same warnings, since hundreds of illnesses and conditions are known to be caused by these foul injections. So this is some really, I find this rather disturbing information. And paired with the thing I talked about just a few minutes ago, where it looks like the reason doing the current manufacturing techniques is because they needed to find a way to do more to step up production. Again, I come to the same conclusion. It's the marketing and sales and profit motivated agendas are more important than the safety issues. And I
can
almost please do.
Okay. I didn't know whether you wanted me to have a conversation about this, but I think in the medical model, no matter what the disease, especially when we're talking about things like cancer or contagious disease, and we do have incidents of smallpox coming back, and with global warming, all of the tropical forest diseases that you might think about are moving north. And that's what they're concerned about. They're concerned about North America and other regions of other continents having an increase in these contagious diseases. And what they're thinking is, when you go in for cancer treatment with chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, whatever it is, they're taking a view of this security versus risk ratio, which we talked about earlier, that, okay, I know if I have a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or something like that, and I take this list of very potentially strong chemotherapy drugs and radiation treatments, whether it's for brain cancer or whatever it is, that I do have a certain statistical risk and chance of then coming down later in life with another form of cancer. That's acknowledged, understood, and you will even hopefully be told this by your physician. So they're saying, in order to cure you now and keep you alive, we're going to give you this very strong poison to your body. We're going to knock out the cells that are the growing cells, where, you know, these are the kinds of things that we do. And in regard to vaccinations, they're so concerned about contagious disease spreading that they're willing to take a risk on the population and the people that there will be adverse effects. That's basically what they're saying. Are you there?
I had my mic muted there, and if you start talking when your mic's muted, people have a hard time hearing you.
Oh, that happens to me all the time. Yeah, so that's kind of the way I think the medical model is looking at that. They're willing to take a risk on people's long-term health for what they would say is a number of years of help better, you know, the risk of having this contagious disease spread. They would rather try and stop it and keep people alive until they can find better ways of doing things. That's kind of what I think is going on.
Perhaps part of the rationale, at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, Debbie, when somebody says throwing a hand grenade in, well, this is our warfare. This is the way of our mentality. Let's go in, knock it out, get rid of whatever it is, the enemy, the disease, and then we'll clean up afterwards, not realizing there might be a different, a better approach overall for everyone's health and safety. Let's go in and spend billions of dollars cleaning up the sanitation, giving people the right nutrition, boosting their immune system so that they will not either get the disease or possibly be able to throw it off much more easily.
Well, until we can set...
Go ahead.
Until we can set that up in a way that doing that will profit the pharmaceutical industry, I would submit that there's a very low likelihood that we'll see that happen, unless the pharmaceutical industry collapses, as some people have suggested as a possibility in the not-too-distant future. We'll have to see what happens.
Right. We're going to watch it unfold maybe in our lifetime.
I've got my fingers crossed.
Okay.
We're up on a break time here, Debbie. I think this maybe is a good time to go ahead and do that and see if Rich Roberts has joined us somewhere in the next couple or few minutes here. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook and Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips. Special guest Rich Roberts with the Pandemic Response Project may be joining us shortly. We're going to go to a short break here first, though, and we hope you'll stick around. We've got a lot more to talk about today, folks. Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is Vaccine Rights Attorney and Freedomizer Radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from libertystickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's libertystickers.com. But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to libertystickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. libertystickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Get ready for the epic new documentary adventure ride of your life. Shades, the motion picture. A view into the globalist domain. And Embellus and Burmese film.
Nothing in this world works the way you think it does. Nothing. Governments do not operate the way you think they do. Banks do not do what you think they do. The police department is not here for what you think it is. Nothing in your world works the way you think it does.
We have had a lot of know the new world government has been identified, and they thought they just cleared the world economy, bring in a worldwide police state, but instead, it's going to bring them down.
You have to stand up, speak up, speak out.
See the motion picture. Order your copy of the DVD today at SheTheMotionPicture.com.
This is Murphy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. Warriors, you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Read about it in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available now at newsstands everywhere. The Sovereign is a monthly 24-page tabloid newspaper featuring incendiary content about life during wartime in the age of Obama. Warriors, keep to date every month. Remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available at newsstands everywhere. This alert is for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action. This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. This is Mercy. Mine will be the last voice you'll ever hear. Don't be alarmed.
Want to spread awareness to your neighbors, family, and friends about what is going on in our country today? It may be things you already know, like the large number of FEMA camps spread around this country to lock up citizens like you and me. What legislators are doing to strip states and people of their sovereign rights. Or legislation giving states the power to force vaccinate under a declared state of emergency. Do your neighbors understand what is going on? William Lewis Films offers the perfect tools to inform our population about this government's tyrannical shift from a constitutional republic to a despotic democracy. Films like 911 Ripple Effect, Beyond Treason, One Nation Under Siege, Washington You're Fired, Camp FEMA, Enemy of the State, Don't Tread on Me, Blood of Patriots, The Ron Paul Uprising, even 911 in Plain Sight, William's first production, are all available at williamlewisfilms.com. Get your DVDs today at williamlewisfilms.com. Educate against the police state.
We're back with Vaccines in Europe and the U.S. with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brooke, who wonderfully is with us today despite being traveling and not being sure if she'd be able to be here today. And my dear friend and special guest today, Rich Roberts, manager of the Pandemic Response Project, also with us here now for this second half-hour, two-hour segment. Rich, how are you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Alan. Thanks for having me on the show. And hello, Debbie. Or maybe Debbie.
Hello. I think I might be. Oh, I'm not on mute. I'm good to go.
That's right. We're not going to let you mute out of here.
Welcome. Glad to hear your voice today.
Oh, well, thank you. And likewise.
By way of just brief introduction, Rich, there's so many things I could tell people about you, but I'm going to keep it short. Most of them would actually be really good. and not all of them legal. No, just kidding. But the pandemic response project is a project that that I originally sourced back during the 2009-10 so-called swine flu pandemic. And the project, in a general sense, is exactly what the label says, a response to that pandemic and the way it was mishandled in so many ways at so many levels, and the corruption that was underlying so much of that. Rich came on board at one point early in the process, asking if there was anything he could do to help, and he's been just an immense help and support with that project. The goal of that project, the long-term goal, is the reform of emergency health laws primarily at the state level, because what we found out when we looked at state laws around the country is that most states have laws that can mandate an emergency vaccine or in the event of an emergency being declared and an emergency vaccine being mandated, that are routine exemptions, the usual religious and philosophical in states that have the and even in medical exemptions go out the window. And people who are concerned about routine immunizations, I tell you, you have even more to be concerned about with an emergency vaccine, because they are typically fast-tracked, which means they're made, they skip some processes or steps in the manufacturing and testing in order to produce the vaccine more quickly. And that of course, means that there's more potential for serious problems with the vaccine. including whether or not it will work and what the adverse reactions may be. And then most states also have the ability, if you refuse a vaccine, an emergency mandated vaccine, they can quarantine you, and it's state officials most of the time who will have the authority to decide where you're going to be quarantined, in a government facility, for example, if they decide, and for how long and so forth. So what we're looking to do with the Pandemic Response Project is to raise awareness on these issues and to encourage and invite people to become involved in their state legislative process to support and promote the passage of laws or reform of existing laws to allow us freedom of choice with vaccines, even in a declared emergency. So, Rich, thanks so much for your help in the past. Thanks for being here today. You got anything in particular you want to dive into in terms of recent or current events with vaccines?
Sure, Alan. I've identified several articles, recent articles here, that should give us plenty to talk about. So let's just jump in here. And the first article that caught my attention this week is, I'm referencing an article from GreenMedInfo, and this is written by Heidi Stevenson, and the title was "The Coming Push to Give HPV Vaccines to Infants." And the title is fairly self-explanatory here, but as you know, Alan, the HPV vaccines, or human papillomavirus, these have been the most dangerous in terms of adverse events that have been reported. And so what could be more insane than a push that is underway to give these vaccinations to infants? You know, currently they're recommending these for young girls around the age of 12, and recently they've expanded that to include boys as well. So now it looks like the push is on to give infants this vaccination. And,
but Rich, I mean, we don't want our newborn infants to have cervical cancer or genital warts. I mean,
well, that's the irony of this is, so we're talking about sexually transmitted diseases essentially, and it's kind of hilarious, but the justification that the folks behind this are using is the current hepatitis B virus, and I'll kind of read this verbatim what they say. They say, this is the justification for giving the HPV to infants, which is no justification at all in my mind, but it says they claim on a global scale, vaccination of newborns and infants is well established and has developed a successful working infrastructure. The hepatitis B virus vaccination programs offer a model for HPV introduction in which newborn and infant immunization achieves a rapid reduction in the prevalence of HPV carrier rates. And so basically the justification is, hey, we already give hepatitis B to babies, so why not give these HPV vaccines to babies? And, you know, Alan, we've talked a lot in the past about how we really can't rationalize giving the hepatitis B vaccine to infants because, again, this is a disease related to sexual transmission or drug use with needles, et cetera, and sharing of needles. And so there was never any logic, as far as I was concerned, to give infants the hepatitis B vaccine. But apparently that's been kind of quoted now as some sort of rationale for pushing another vaccine on infants. And as far as I can see, this is really all about pushing this vaccine, which from the pharmaceutical point of view is undersold. And so I don't know. This one is a real head-scratcher. I don't see how you can possibly justify this. And the justification
Rich,
is just empty talk.
I think there's a critical point you're missing here. You know, when you were reading the quote there and you read the word infrastructure, see, the writer left out the word financial in front of that word infrastructure. See, you're thinking about this in health terms, and that's not what it's about. It's about there's a well-established financial infrastructure based on this hepatitis B vaccine because, of course, that's the only possible rationale for it. You know, head-scratcher is such a polite word but an apt one nonetheless. It just makes no sense. And I just wanted to sort of take it a step further. You know, nobody any longer can deny that vaccines come with a risk of injury and death. The federal government pays out roughly $100 million a year to vaccine victims and their families, and the FDA and CDC, among others, have told us that that may represent only 1 to 10% of the events actually occurring, I mean, because a very, very small percentage of events ever get reported. And so the reality of vaccine injury and death is just as well established, if not more so, than whatever infrastructure they were referring to. But the problem I have is with this. You know, there are infants who are disabled and killed by the hepatitis B vaccine. So we are, as a nation, requiring or allowing to be required a risk of injury and death for every newborn child without adding another vaccine. Let's just start with what we're doing right now, the hepatitis B vaccine. We don't even require in this country right now our new young adults, 18-year-olds, to do service in the military, even though we've been supposedly at war now for how many years? When was the war on terror declared or enacted, if it wasn't formally declared? But we've had this war on terror for years and years. We've been sending people to Iraq and Afghanistan and other countries, risking their lives, many of them still dying. We don't even require adults to take that risk, and yet we require newborn infants to risk injury and death for the presumed benefit of others. It's not even like a contagious disease where if you're in the same room with someone, you might contract it. You know, this is a sexually transmitted disease, as we're talking about with both of these vaccines for the most part. And I mean, I think that we could safely say that a vast majority of newborn infants are not intravenous drug users or sexually promiscuous, you know. So now, I don't have a hard statistic on that. I'm just speculating.
Well, that it definitely is an eye-opener because, you know, when we look at the Gardasil vaccination, it's definitely documented to be the most dangerous. And yet, you know, that is the one that is chosen to be given to infants. I mean, it definitely, just in and of itself, leads to dark suspicions. And so it's just baffling how this works. And I speculate that, you know, if they're going to push this for infants, does that mean that that's also a mechanism for getting these HPV vaccines added to the mandatory or so-called mandatory kind of list of vaccinations?
Well, let me tell you one thing. Yeah, let me tell you one thing I see going on here, Rich. We saw independent research looking at the swine flu vaccine that you may recall was heavily promoted for pregnant women. For some reason, pregnant women who should never, ever get a vaccine at all unless it's just really, really critical, and this is the mainstream view up until the swine flu vaccine, we saw that there was something on the order of a 2,500% increase in flu vaccine-related pregnancy terminations, miscarriages, and the like, with the swine flu vaccine compared to the prior year's regular seasonal flu vaccine. Here's the problem, Rich. See, there was this huge push for the swine flu vaccine. It just didn't catch on as well as they had wanted it to. And so they just were not able to address the population issue as successfully as they had wanted to. And so they're having to go the next step now and go ahead and try to get them after they're born. So let's add another vaccine that is the most reactive vaccine, and let's add that to the newborn schedule. And if we couldn't terminate them during the pregnancy, we'll get them after they're born. Now, obviously, I'm talking in disturbingly dark humor here. But, Rich, I just don't see what else, you know, how else you can view this other than something that's just a totally mindless and careless greed-based goal for getting as much money as you can. You know, the reason that you give a newborn a vaccine is because you can. Because you make money, people will accept it, and some people will complain, but you can suppress that. And that's the only reason to do it, is because you can, because you can get away with it. Because there certainly isn't any health-based justification for it, and no health-based justification for giving an HPV vaccine to anybody, let alone a newborn infant. So it's just so disturbing. Debbie, you've been patiently quiet during all of this. Do you have anything you want to chime in on?
Yes, I think that I have that broad view always of the two camps, the two groups. One, dealing with safety, parents on the ground, having to cope with outcomes from the vaccines, and the other group being government concerns about compliance as a main ingredient to their decision-making process, that they want, they know that people are not going to keep going back for more and more vaccines, so they want to give them, number one, as early as possible. And if you think about a newborn reaching new parents, young parents who perhaps have not been educated about the vaccine issues, then they're more likely to go ahead and just get these vaccines into these infants, into young children, until later on when the adverse effects start to occur, then the parents become more educated, and then they want to make a decision, you know, have a little bit more empowerment. So get them early, get the compliance there, and brainwash or use your propaganda, your marketing skills to tell everyone you need to get these shots. I am here on the West Coast right now, and I just went to a little, I think it was Walgreens, and there were five big placards as you walk into the store. One, get your malaria vaccine, get your influenza vaccine, why do I need a get your whooping cough vaccine? And I'm thinking to myself, why would I need to get these five different shots? What's going on here, and why are they covering so many different illnesses with vaccines? It just makes me want to be more proactive as an adult, as a parent, to question. But other people might just think, oh, my gosh, I'm walking in here. I better get it for myself and my children because something's happening in our country that there's a spread of disease. So those are the kinds of ways that people might be thinking or government might be thinking.
Well, I'd like to take it one step further, Debbie, and I really appreciate, by the way, that you come in with some perspective from more than one side of the issue. Vaccines are a very polarizing issue, and people often tend to fall very hard in a pro-vaccine or anti-vaccine camp. And it's really helpful to have someone come in from time to time and say, well, look, there are, you know, whether I agree or disagree with any given view is another issue, but here are some of the different perspectives. So first of all, thank you for helping to bring some balance to what admittedly is predominantly an imbalanced view when we're talking from, and to the extent that we're talking from an anti-vaccine or pro-alternative vaccine view. But I want to mention, I probably have mentioned this in the past, but it really bears mentioning here, I think, because, you know, Rich has brought out a really important point that there is some strong data supporting that the HPV vaccines are the most dangerous ones, the most highly reactive, have the largest number or percentage of attributed deaths and disabilities, and many, many young women have lost their lives to the vaccine or who had perfectly healthy, wonderful lives and big futures ahead of them taken away from them. One article recently on Natural News, they just citing one example of a 16-year-old in Australia who went into menopause. You know, she will potentially live a long life, but she'll never know motherhood or womanhood in some of the most fundamental respects. And to have something like that yanked away from you as a result of a shot that took you a few seconds to get is just something I can't imagine somebody ever fully healing from or coming to terms with or accepting. It's just these kinds of things are just monstrous in their impacts. But we have some real interesting information that came to light pretty recently from a woman by the name of Sherry Edwards. If somebody wants to Google her, her first name is unusual spelling of Sherry. It's S-H-A-R-R-Y. And Sherry has been working in the field of bioacoustics for the last 20 or 30 years, and she has developed some very interesting research and research techniques. And she has something that she calls vocal profiling, where she has learned that you can tell very detailed information by the frequency content of someone's voice. So she can do, for example, a 30-second recording of someone speaking or talking, have that analyzed by a computer program that just mathematically takes apart the voice sample and looks at the frequency content. And it turns out that there is a very high correlation, strong correlation between the frequency content and very detailed, specific conditions at that time of someone's body and system, physiologically and even psychologically, mentally, emotionally. And she took a sample off of one of my radio shows and processed it and sent me the results. And I mean this in a positive way. It was scary to me how detailed and accurate the information was. And then there were things she told me about myself that I didn't know whether or not it was true. I just didn't have the information. Now, if somebody tells
you
you're...
You went ahead and ordered a consultation, a report?
No, she just voluntarily took a sample of my voice from a radio show, ran it through software that analyzed the frequencies, and then sent me the results. She wanted to give me a demonstration of this process.
Okay.
So here's what I'm getting to. Long story short, she has used this technique of vocal profiling. Now, she's done research with the military. She's done research with reputable university researchers. She's got some validation for the work she's done, and she has medical doctors who incorporate her research and programs into their own practices. So this is a technique that's not lacking. It's not just something totally out of the blue that somebody made up. It's something that she's been working with for literally decades at this point, and she has some credible formal research backing up this technique. The long story short here, Sherry has used this to look at women who have had the HPV vaccine, and what she sees is damage to the reproductive system in connection with this vaccine. Now, let's assume for a moment that these results tell us something scientifically on a causal level, that there's a causal relationship between the vaccine and reproductive damage. That doesn't mean that that was something that anybody, any other researchers, vaccine researchers and developers knew about or planned or intended. It could very well be something that was inadvertent. They haven't looked for it in the research and they haven't found it. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that that's a possibility. I want to add one more piece of information, though. Merck, which is the manufacturer of the Gardasil vaccine, there are two main HPV vaccines, Gardasil and Cervarix. And Merck manufactures Gardasil, which is the one that's primarily used here in the U.S. Merck recently lowered the cost of their Gardasil vaccine. Now, let me take a quick sidestep here. This is a company that's part of an industry where it is common for companies in this industry, the pharmaceutical industry, to get fines, criminal and civil fines, in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and there have even been billion-dollar criminal and civil fines for the illegal marketing of their drugs. In other words, this is an industry that routinely engages in criminal behavior to maximize their profits. So, Merck, a member of this industry, lowers the cost of their HPV vaccine by 95% so that they can sell it to the third world and vaccinate as many people in the third world with the HPV vaccine as they can. Now, I'm speculating here. I'm extrapolating from the information that I've given you here, and I'm drawing a tentative conclusion, but I find it very difficult not to come to this tentative conclusion. Here's a vaccine that we have some scientific evidence affects the reproductive system. Here's a company doing exactly the opposite of what is routine in the industry. They actually lower their price by a profound amount. And they want to take this product that affects reproductive systems and vaccinate as many people in third world as they can with it. I have a hard time not at least considering the possibility that there's a fertility population control agenda underneath this. But even if there's no deliberate intent there, and I'm skeptical that there would not be, it looks like there is a very possible, if not likely, effect. It's almost, for short-term purposes, doesn't matter whether it's on purpose or not, it looks like that's what's going to happen. And that sort of thing causes me great concern. I would be delighted, Rich and Debbie, to hear any comments either one of you have about anything I just said or anything else there. We're coming up near the half hour, so we'll need to take a break shortly, but feel free, either one of you, to chime in and share your thoughts.
Well, Alan, I completely agree with you that a 95% price reduction, that is astronomical. And so it seems as if the profit motive trying to get this out into the third world. So I think your suspicions are well-founded. And I would also just like to say I really thought Debbie said about introducing vaccines to infants was right on, and I had not thought of that. But, you know, I remember when I had my first child in the hospital. I would have done anything the doctor said. I was kind of in a very sort of happy space, and I just wanted to kind of be able to get out of the hospital. And so it's not a time when people are in a mode to question medical authorities, and so that kind of slipped by me that might be a primary motivation for pushing more and more vaccines onto younger people. And also just to kind of maximize damage, you know, if we're going to go from a eugenics point of view. But, you know, as we talk about HPV, there's a major effort on in Japan to ban these vaccinations from the country. And I probably don't have time to get into a lot of details, but there's another article about that. So how ironic that at a point in time where so-called authorities and the industry is pushing to give HPV vaccines to infants, we have, you know, a major developed country which is raising an outcry that they don't even want this vaccine at all. So very interesting.
Well, that's a really good point, Rich. Thanks for bringing that out, because that's a wonderful sharp contrast that they don't want it at all for their, young women. And here we are preparing, at least according to this article, to potentially add it to a newborn infant schedule. Debbie, you have any thoughts there before we go to break on this? And we have a caller on the line. Caller, thank you for your patience. Please stay with us. We'll get to you right after the break.
Right. Well, my thought is that even way back in 2010, there was an article on National News about Bill Gates says vaccines can help reduce world population. You know, if people could have thought of that as an outlier, as you know, you're really pushing the boundaries by making such a claim. And yet, over the years, we're going to be learning more and more details about the effects of these types of vaccines and the ingredients that can be causing damage to the reproductive organs. Reducing the sperm count and viability is something that we already see. And when we see loss of fertility in women. So there is reason we understand why people in other countries are fearful. And we've seen and read about some killings of the nurses who were doing the vaccine injections into the small towns. And that's because they have these fears, and maybe they are not unfounded. We will see as it plays out over time. with more I think the other remark I wanted to make about what you were saying in terms of her name is Shari Edwards, and she, it seems to me that she's doing really good work, and with that, it's like this sound is a vibration, it's a resonance, it's a fingerprint, it's a DNA, sound waves, you cannot deny it, it is completely scientific, and if it shows anomalies or repeated abnormalities in a smooth frequency, then we actually do have data to look upon and say, okay, if a woman gets this type of injection or another type of injection, we're going to see this formation on the screen in terms of wavelength, and it's going to be consistent. And that's science. So I think we're going to see more of this.
Well, Shari has some real fascinating research in terms of its implications for diagnosis and treatment as well. She has worked with using sound not just as a sort of a detection, but also as a frequency approach to healing. She has some fascinating work in that area as well. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. today at this point with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brooke, special guest Rich Roberts, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. We're going to go to break, folks. We will be back with you in just a little bit. We've got a caller on the line. We'll get to you right after break. Don't go away. We'll see you in just a little bit.
Hello, everyone. Proof here again. I want to let you know about our brand new sponsor, Silver Leaf Tea. Now, as you guys know that have listened to me for years, I am a tea aficionado. I have hundreds of different flavors and styles at my house. And Silver Leaf has exactly the kind of stuff that I look for. I love loose tea, great antioxidants. I just love the taste of it. And this Silver Leaf has black, they have green, they have white, they have organic. Great for hot tea and iced tea. Silver Leaf Tea, it's right on our website, freedomizerradio.com. And check it out and order it. Silver Leaf Tea. Hello again, Freedomist. Proof is here, and I want to talk to you about a brand new soda maker called SodaStream. Now, the Proof House has had SodaStream for about a year, and we love the thing. We use it quite often. With SodaStream, you can have fresh-made soda in seconds. One of the big things we like about it is that there's no high-fructose corn syrup and no aspartame. There's over 60 flavors, or you can create your own. Not just sodas, they also have iced teas and energy drinks. Here at the Proof House, we make egg cream sodas all the time. Some other facts to consider here, there's no electricity, no more wasted bottles and cans, and the most important thing is that it tastes great. Keep in mind, too, this is a perfect family present for Christmas, or, hey, just surprise the family with something great. Also, for a limited time, there's free shipping, so go to freedomizerradio.com and look for the SodaStream link, and I hope you check out the product. That's SodaStream right on freedomizerradio.com.
Come listen to Ancient of Days, where we talk about the lies, misrepresentations, and holes in the history we learned in school. Mondays, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Freedomizer. Thank you.
Welcome, Freedomizers. This is Juan Hicks of Juan's Media Matrix. Be sure to tune into my show every Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. From time to time, I'll be featuring special guest interviews along with the latest news headlines from around the world. You're always welcome to call into the show by dialing 347-324-3704 and pressing 1. Otherwise, you can listen to the latest show in progress. Be sure to join us also at www.freedomizerradio.com on your computer or tablet, where you can interact with our listeners in the chat room as well as comment on the show. We also have a large variety of shows throughout the broadcast day at www.freedomizerradio.com, each with its own unique host covering a wide range of topics to keep you informed on issues that the mainstream media refuses to touch. Once again, that's www.freedomizerradio.com, or you can listen by phone by calling 347-324-3704. Be sure to tune in.
Hi, I'm Tiger Lily, show host for Tiger Lily's Freedom Roar on Freedomizer Radio. I like to have philosophical discussions about government, religion, politics, and most importantly, peaceful parenting. These are all topics that tend to be taboo at dinner tables, social gatherings, and even around water coolers. But we must talk about police brutality, government corruption, the forced indoctrination of our children, and lamestream media propaganda. I hope you'll join me on Tiger Lily's Freedom Roar, so that together we can begin to cover these issues with open minds and hearts. Every Friday from 11 to noon Pacific Time on Freedomizer Radio.
Well, welcome back to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips, co-host Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, and special guest today, Rich Roberts, with, among many other wonderful associations, manager of the Pandemic Response Project. Well, I think we lost our caller over the break. Looks like it from the switchboard here, so we'll just jump back to the news. Rich, what else you got going for us today?
Well, I wanted to just quickly revisit the information about what was going on in Japan with HPV since we were speaking about HPV so broadly.
Yes, please.
And basically there's an organization, the National Cervical Cancer Vaccine Victim Liaison Committee. That's a mouthful. But apparently that is some sort of international activism group. but anyway, what they have done is they've kind of started a petition, and they're asking people internationally to sign it. And they're just basically asking to ban the HPV vaccination from Japan. And I'm referencing an article here from SaneVax, and it's just called Urgent Request from Japan, Help Stop HPV Vaccinations, and this is by Norma Erickson. But there were some statistics here I wanted to quote because, I'm going on what's quoted here in the article, and I don't see references from where these come from, but they're quite dramatic. They're saying here that the rate of serious adverse reactions that Japanese women in particular experienced after the Cervarix injection are 52 times the rate of adverse events reported after the flu vaccines. So, I already kind of thought of the flu vaccine as a very hot vaccine in terms of adverse events. So they're saying that with Cervarix, they're getting 52 times the rate of adverse events. And then with Gardasil, which is the form of the HPV vaccine we're maybe more familiar with here in the U.S., they're still getting 22 times the number of adverse events over and above the flu shot. And then it goes on to quote, and perhaps even more dramatic statistic, it says only 0.7%, so that's less than 1%, of Japanese women experience infections with HPV 16 or 18. And so 16 or 18 would be the main components that the vaccine would supposedly protect against. So less than 1% of the Japanese women are infected with those viruses. And then it goes on to say that 90% of those infections clear up on their own without any medical intervention. So we're down to less than 1/100th of a percent of the people that this even affects. So, the conclusion is that there's really no evidence that the vaccines are going to reduce cancer, and there's no reason to expose these women to the risk of these adverse reactions from these unproven vaccines. And so essentially, they're asking people to sign the petition. They want to ban the use of HPV vaccines altogether in Japan. They want to investigate all who were vaccinated. They want to acknowledge any serious adverse reactions that have occurred, and then they want to establish treatment and generous relief, as in financial relief, for victims. So it would be wonderful if they could get that. if Big Pharma actually had to kind of comply with that, that would be a very time-consuming and expensive proposition, and maybe that would convince them that they do not want to keep doing these kinds of things. Another very interesting point here, I'm looking at this article, and at the top, the SaneVax team came back in after this article was published and said that a few hours after posting the article, that the petition that they had linked to the article had been removed from the website or made inaccessible, as if it had been at least temporarily hacked so that people couldn't go in and even sign the petition to, you know, show their support for this. But anyway, very interesting in light of, you know, everything going on with HPV, and, you know, here we have an entire nation sort of rising up against it and some very eye-opening statistics. And still, in light of all of this, you know, we have a push to vaccinate newborn babies with this vaccine. It's really insane.
It's just hard to imagine, you know, if you were talking about something that was much more subtle, I could see still a debate. It's just so mind-boggling. How does this ever even become an issue in the first place when you have such profound arguments against doing it at all? And, you know, Rich, we talk about, you know, and people talk about, for example, the eugenics or fertility or population control agendas. And, you know, a lot of it, honestly, I think at least one layer of the vaccine issue is more purely financial. When vaccines cause adverse events, a relatively small percentage of people will die. A much larger percentage of people will have some kind of disability or chronic disease, and that creates a whole market, perhaps for an entire lifetime of that those injured people, for more pharmaceutical products. So it's not just the profits on the vaccines. You know, it reminds me, I remember at one point, and this may still be the case, but I remember at one point years ago where I became aware that there was such competition in the computer market, for example, for printers. When I first bought a printer, I spent, I don't know, $400 or $500 for something that had very, very basic capabilities compared to today's printers. And that market got very competitive. And at one point, it was my impression that some printer manufacturers were actually taking a loss on their printers in order to compete and get their printers in people's hands. But then you have to keep periodically buying the ink cartridges. And that's where they made their profit, by selling ink cartridges over and over again to people who had their printer, because then you have to buy their ink cartridges and they're more free in that position to have a higher markup and have a higher profit percentage off the cartridges than off the printer itself. Once you get the printer in their hands, you've got them locked in for as long as they are using that printer. So
right.
It seems to me like there's a similar sort of mentality sometimes that applies here. Even if the vaccines broke even or they took a short-term loss, going to have a long-term game on all the other pharmaceutical products they're going to be selling you to treat your injured child, which they, of course, hope you will never connect to the vaccines.
Well, that's a good point, too, Alan.
So much of this, again, at one level, I think a lot of it is market-driven. You know, it costs millions of dollars to develop the vaccines, although, you know, the federal government subsidizes that pretty heavily, so I'm not sure the investment on the pharmaceutical companies is really anywhere near as much as it could be. Let's put it like that.
Right. Well, that does make sense. If you're analyzing it from a profit-only point of view, then certainly you don't have to just look at an individual drug or vaccine to kind of determine that it could be profitable in the big scheme of things.
But I've come to the conclusion, I'll give you another one of my tentative conclusions, and this admittedly, again, is speculation, but I have come to the conclusion, because I keep seeing the fertility aspect come up in different ways from different angles at different times, it just keeps coming up, that it's really hard to draw any conclusion other than that's a deliberate part of a total agenda. But I think there are different layers to the agenda, and I think the financial part in many instances, is an implementation tool for what is ultimately a non-financial agenda. For example, as we've discussed on this show repeatedly in the past, healthcare workers are being increasingly required to get flu shots or they'll lose their jobs. Now, there are several peer-reviewed published studies, articles, independent researchers who have come out and said, look, the flu vaccines don't work. We've even had federal agencies, the OSHA, come out a couple of years ago and say there's no credible research supporting mandatory flu shots. And yet, we see flu shots being increasingly mandated all over the country with healthcare officials. How are they doing that if there's no science? Well, it's been set up so that if the hospitals don't get 90% compliance rate, they don't vaccinate 90% of their staff, they can lose, according to some sources, up to 2% of their Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements. And for those who may not be aware, hospitals run a pretty tight profit margin. That 2%, some hospitals have as much as, I was told recently, 80% of their income is Medicaid and Medicare. You take 2% of that away, you're going to see a hospital collapse. In fact, I just read an article about a hospital. Gosh, where was this? I don't remember if it was New York or some other place. I think it was in the northeast portion of the U.S. But in any case, read an article about a hospital that is shutting down all their services except for emergency services. And the local community is very, very concerned about that. Probably they're doing it at the end of the day for financial reasons. But you know, there are shifts and changes upon us here, but it's the healthcare industry is a for-profit industry, and so we can't blame them, at least up to a point, with structuring their business as a business, trying to maximize their profits, trying to cut their losses and minimize their expenses like any other business. I personally see great difficulty with the idea of medicine being a free enterprise system, and I don't have the perfect solution off the tip of my tongue here, but it seems to me that when you have a for-profit system, at least where healthcare is concerned, that inevitably the people in that industry, as with any other industry, but the implications are far more critical in healthcare, they are going to bump up against moral, ethical, and legal boundaries. Well, what does the pharmaceutical industry do when it bumps up against those boundaries? It makes a financial calculation, and then it acts accordingly. And if they can profit from crossing those boundaries, they do that. And the evidence of this assertion on my part is the many, many fines and hundreds of millions of dollars and even billions of dollars in some of those criminal fines. And so clearly, moral, ethical, and legal boundaries for this industry are merely financial considerations. So is that a byproduct, at least to some degree, of a capitalistic system? You know, we could debate that. I personally think it is. In fact, I think it's an inevitable byproduct given human nature, at least as we are in our current state of evolution. So some inherently problematic things here. I think the long-term solution will require some kind of restructuring of our current society. Does that mean, you know, we don't have capitalism? Maybe, maybe not. You know, let's find the best system. I don't care what the label is. Let's find the one that promotes wellness and health and safety and not profit over those things.
Well, you know, I agree, Alan. I mean, it seems obvious that a big part of the problem is just economic conflict of interest, and that's obviously a huge part of it. And I have enough faith in my fellow human beings that I think that most people who are caught up in the corruption of the pharmaceutical industry, that is really their motivation. It's just not that that's good, but to kind of have an economic conflict of interest is better than to have some sort of secret occult agenda to depopulate the planet, of course. And, you know, more and more I feel comfortable at least kind of talking theoretically about that because of just the evidence of what we see. And I think the big danger is that hiding behind the economic sphere, you know, you really can have that sort of diabolical evil. And it's hard to kind of see it through the economic sphere because the profit motive becomes like a very convenient excuse. It's like, well, why did You know, why are they pushing these vaccines on babies? Well, they want to make money. And so it becomes like a kind of a very knee-jerk reaction that can hide a much uglier reality. And, you know, I've talked to you about this before, too, Alan. It's like, you know, we see these big pharmaceutical companies getting sued, all these millions and billions of dollars. And, you know, and we can kind of rationalize that economically and say, well, that's just a drop in a bucket compared to what they're going to make off of it. But, you know, my question is, who are they really paying the money to? Because, you know, when they come out with these questionable products, it's one thing for industry driven by profit to come out with, you know, dangerous products and kind of rationalize it like, well, we're just trying to make money, so maybe we're not concerned about safety. But what's really scary is then when you see all the regulators, the people who are supposed to kind of, you know, regulate safety, get on board and promote the unsafe products and do everything they can to cover up the truth about the damage been done. That's when you really know, I think, that you're dealing with a level of corruption that goes beyond just economic interest. Of course, you know, the industry can buy off politicians, so that it does come into it that way. But I guess my question is, you know, it seems like at some level we're dealing with all the same people. If the regulators and the industry people are all the same people, then when they a big pharmaceutical company gets sued, who are they really paying that money to? Do they just basically take it out of one pocket and put it in another? Because, you know, the feds are constantly giving huge grants to these companies and subsidizing their activities. So what does it mean if, you know, Merck pays $1 billion to the government? Is that really even a penalty, ultimately, if you could track that money trail?
Boy, that's a really good point, Rich. I hadn't even connected those dots on my own. Thanks for calling that to my attention. Sure, if they're going to have the money handed right back to them to subsidize vaccine development or other drug research and development, you know, everybody's just paying everybody else off and everybody's happy, everybody at least who's part of that system.
That's right. And, you know, the little people think, oh, yeah, they really were punished this time. They had to pay out all these billions of dollars. Well, nobody ever goes to jail. Nobody's charged with murder or felony. It's just, you know, a company that's already filthy rich gives a bunch of money to a governmental group, which, as far as we can tell, they're completely in cahoots one with another. The way that they're regulated and the way that industry and government people just sort of, there's a revolving door, you know, back and forth between the two. So, you know, who are we kidding here, you know? It just seems like a lot of these so-called financial penalties are probably bogus, and it puts us in a position where it's probably darn near impossible for us to prove this. But just think how lax these companies seem to be about getting these fines and paying them out, and nothing ever changes. They just sort of happily pay these enormous fines and go right on.
Well, you know, when Pfizer got their $1 billion criminal fine and $1.3 billion civil fine back in 2009, one of the reasons given for the criminal fine being so high was that it was the fourth time they'd been caught doing the same thing since 2002. And what that strongly suggests is they have so much money they don't know what to do with it, so they have to engage in criminal behavior so they have a way to give it away, which I don't personally think is very likely. Or what it says is they're profiting so much from this behavior that it doesn't, you know, let's go ahead and get the, you know, hopefully we won't get the fine and we'll profit even more. But if we do, what the heck? And I've never seen an article reporting on these fines that said, you know, they had to pay this $1 billion criminal fine or this $1 billion criminal fine or this many hundred millions of dollars, whatever it is in any given instance. But by the way, they actually profited, you know, $8 billion, and so they came out ahead $5 billion. You know, we don't see the math in the articles. If you even see an article that reports it at all, and you don't see it in the mainstream news much, if at all. But when you do see an article, you don't see the math there. You don't see the rest of the story that will tell you essentially why they behave like this. Because, and the bottom line is because, as you point out, no one goes to jail, and they profit from it ultimately. So But it raises such a profound moral and ethical issue for those of us who, as individuals, cannot wrap our mind around the idea of somebody deliberately engaging in criminal behavior. And a criminal fine, if it leaves the company with a net profit, is not a disincentive.
That's right.
And so the behavior continues.
It's really an incentive in the sense that, you know, if they feel like if they get busted, the penalty is going to be so slight that it's really not even going to affect their business. And so in that sense, it's really an incentive to keep doing it. But, yeah, again, the really concerning question for me is, did they really pay a penalty at all? Because, you know, I'm just concerned that the money just finds its way right back to them again, and so it becomes a complete charade. And so, anyway, food for thought. That would be an interesting kind of research topic to take on. It's like, where does that money go? Or it'd be interesting to look at, you know, if the government fines a big company in a calendar year, did they turn around later and sort of subsidize, you know, in some a huge way, the company's business, or how did that money really flow back and forth?
Well, it's a really good question. It's analogous to the so-called revolving door, where we see people working in federal agencies, and then they leave from there and go work in the industry or vice versa. And there's just this incestuous relationship between industry and government in situations where to have integrity and to function properly, there would have to be a complete bright red line between industry and government. You know, no one should be able to leave the government and go work in industry unless there's some significant lapse of time, 5 years, 10 years, something that, for all practical purposes at least, precludes there being any conflict of interest there. But we don't have anything like that in our legal system, and so these problems continue to play out, and industry continues to use the system to its advantage fully, and even to the point of routinely violating civil and criminal laws. We're at another break point, believe it or not. The time is flying by here. It's fascinating conversations, guys. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., and chiming in on and off with us today, Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook. Debbie, delighted to have you with us today because we weren't certain whether Debbie was going to be able to get in at all today. She's traveling, so we just really appreciate, Debbie, you taking the extra effort and being here with us to provide your really insightful contributions. And also Rich Roberts from the Pandemic Response Project. Rich, as well, just wonderful to have your insights and comments today. We're going to go to a break here. We'll be back in just a little bit, folks. Stay with us. We've got another half hour to go. Lots more to talk about, and we will get to it right after this.
Hey, it's Red from the Red Pill Show. Join me on Sunday nights from 8 p.m. Central Standard Time to 9:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. Are you getting upset or angry from the New World Order? Yes, because fear leads to anger, and anger leads to the dark side. So if you want to get past your anger, then come join me. Figure out what's really going on the Red Pill Show.
Hey there, everyone. This is Chrissy Featherstone, the host of the new show, Real Talk USA, on FreedomizerRadio.com. Join me every Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is a seriously but yet funny show. Topics will range from current events to psychological factors in America from the scientific approach, and this will be happening every Sunday. We have musical artists that will also come on, and I love banter from the listeners. The show will also offer and feature listener choice topics every third Sunday. So call in to 347-324-3704 or join us in the chat room at freedomizerradio.com.
Hey, Freedomist, join me, Proof Negative, weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together, right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
How's it going, Freedomizers? This is Ferdinand. Join me on the No Bull Zone every Monday night from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We talk about everything from local to national issues, how to be free, and even throw in some health talks. Call in to chat or suggest a topic. That's the No Bull Zone every Monday evening from 8 to 9 p.m. East Coast Time, only on Freedomizer Radio.
Lindsay Williams on Freedomizer Radio.
Proof Negative, I love the title that you use on your radio. I've thought about it ever since we talked on off of the air the other day, and I'd say that that's an excellent title for a talk show host.
Let's push for liberty.
Last push for liberty. Monday midnight, 12:30 a.m. Central Standard Time, Tuesday night, 11 p.m. Central Standard Time. Freedomizer Radio.
Well, we're back with Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. Homeopathy World Community Founder Debbie Brook, Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips, special guest Rich Roberts, and great to have you guys back here for the last segment of the show. Ordinarily, in this part of the show, Debbie's talking to us about homeopathy. She's traveling this week, and I believe not bringing us a segment today on homeopathy, so we'll continue with a discussion about vaccines and vaccine issues. Rich, you want to help us pick up where we left off or else go on to another topic if there's yet something else you'd like to direct our attention to?
Yes, why don't we kind of change gears here a little bit and take up another topic. And this one might be a little more pedestrian, I don't know, but I think it is very interesting how this stuff plays out. But I'm looking at an article here from Underground. And certainly we don't have to just reference this article to talk about this next issue. But it is an interesting article. It's by Mark Miller, and it's called Big Pharma's Faking a Grassroots Campaign to Keep Jenny McCarthy Off the View. So that really caught my attention, that headline. And it kind of brings up the question of, you know, Jenny McCarthy is an interesting case, and I certainly support her and Generation Rescue, and, you know, I think she's very sincere when she speaks about her son, and so, you know, I love having her on our team. But it's interesting, you know, who does get on the air and the politics surrounding it, and so I just kind of like to initiate in this direction a little bit. And maybe you've talked about this on the show before, Alan, since this kind of has been a hot topic for the last few weeks, but it's interesting that kind of what this article is pointing out here is that the pharmaceutical companies were trying to make it out as if there were a grassroots sort of parent-driven movement protesting Jenny McCarthy being on The View, as if, you know, everyday people just didn't want to have this kind of risk of somebody, you know, advocating that vaccines could be dangerous and that could that could threaten vaccination rates, et cetera. But when we really kind of take a look at the details, the organization behind this is Voices for Vaccines, and, of course, they have all sorts of conflicts of interest and financial ties to the industry. And one in particular whose name has come up many times before is Paul Offit, who is on the scientific advisory board of the Voices for Vaccines.
So pretty interesting that, you know, they go to these lengths to try to kind of cover their tracks. And, you know, I think it's also interesting that, you know, I get the sense that Big Pharma is disappointed that they haven't been able to spark that sort of grassroots kind of parental movement against the anti-vaxxers, coming from, you know, in my mind, the mistaken point of view that by not vaccinating our kids, we're putting their kids in danger, which makes no sense to me, but it seems like the pharmaceutical companies had counted on the fact that ultimately they would be able to start up that kind of trouble between the vaxxers and non-vaxxers. But, you know, they kind of find out, just like any of us activists do, that it's hard to motivate the people to get excited about much of anything. And so I don't really see that Big Pharma is really ever going to get that kind of grassroots effort behind them. And so they're sort of faking it in this instance. And
well,
so
Rich,
it's interesting.
They've come after us with fluoride and GMOs and vaccines and all these different things to pacify us, and then they wonder why they can't get us riled up to, you know, support their cause. So I just got to say, well, you know, that one worked against them. But, you know, when you control the media, you have the opportunity to create the illusion of anything you want to, really, about what is or isn't going on in the world. And all you've got to do is, you know, put up the face that there's the movement against Jenny McCarthy, and at least some people will buy into it. Perhaps ironically, I think it sparks a lot of anger and conflict and controversy, and maybe even brings more attention to the whole issue because of that. Because Jenny's a pretty she's a pretty controversial figure on the issue. She has caused a lot of sparks, and she has some real courage to speak out and to speak her mind and to put herself, basically paint a target on her back, you know,
right,
as anybody who speaks out on an alternative issue does. And what are your thoughts about that, by the way? What do you think she has, on the whole, has been an effective contribution to raising awareness on the issue, and that she's a good person to do that?
Well, you know, I said before, I'm glad to have her on our side, and, you know, anybody who is sincere on this issue and is concerned about vaccines and the damage that they cause, as, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that is a big plus. That's a positive benefit to our side. But there is, you know, a kind of an interesting question here, and that is, you know, why do the networks allow Jenny McCarthy to go on The View at all? You know, It almost seems like to me sometimes, Alan, that they play the game of allowing the people to get on the mainstream that they think that they can control or debate effectively. And, you know, I don't see Andrew Wakefield going on there and, you know, speaking. It's more like somebody like Jenny McCarthy. I get the feeling that, you know, the networks and the pharmaceuticals, they think they can discredit her because they can present her as just, you know, a well-meaning mother who's just confused about the science or something, and that maybe she's not going to be as articulate as many other people, you know, debating the issue. But I don't know. You know, we'll see. I think any kind of controversy that she will spark will at least get people talking about the issue, which I think is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, or even just she can be shot down on credentials. You pull somebody up with MD after their name, and then for some listeners and viewers anyway, what somebody who doesn't have those credentials says is just automatically invalidated.
Right.
Of course, as we know, there are many well-educated parents and others in the alternative vaccine arena without credentials who know much more about what's really going on with vaccines than perhaps a majority of medical doctors who, and I mean this not as an insult to the doctors, well, not as much as it might initially sound anyway, are going by what they've been taught and what the pressure on them within their community is, which is to endorse vaccines, promote vaccines. If you have anything bad to say, you don't ever actually say it. There's just tremendous pressure on doctors not to be anti-vaccine, at least by appearance. And so those who do think for themselves quickly discover that there's not room or very little room, if any, in the medical profession to speak openly about your views unless you're going along with the status quo, with the party line. So it's complicated on many, many levels, and the medical politics and other kinds of politics is certainly a huge piece of it.
I'd like to throw in a wrinkle. Can I make a notation here that, no, we could look at it in negative light about the mainstream media having control and whatnot, but you can think about this Jenny McCarthy issue as a step in the right direction, that enough visible people who have celebrity status or authority, perhaps Barbara Walters, has seen enough damage in family members to begin questioning, and other people in the, I guess, television industry or maybe movie industry, maybe they are beginning to question the status quo, and slowly we're going to see more people coming in to speak up for their own personal life history. People like Andrew Wakefield has already been discredited. I don't think that getting him on the air is going to make a difference. I think a lot of people are behind Jenny, mothers in particular, parents who have had an event in their own life with their family members. So I am looking at this as a positive to have her on. And as many people try to discredit her, I think there'll be just as many people who will adore her.
It's a really good point, Debbie, and thanks again for playing the other side there. I would have to agree with you that I'm cautiously optimistic, but basically on the whole optimistic that ultimately it's a positive thing. If there is some element of, oh, let's get her on there so we can discredit her, it's a huge risk if that really is the strategy from anyone's point of view, because it may be that, you do not want to incur the wrath of a mother. And here is a mother.
Protecting their young.
Exactly. And here is a mother herself, and who has a growing population of other concerned and in some cases angry mothers whose children have been hurt, or they have a friend or relative whose kids have been hurt by vaccines. There is, at the end of the day, a formidable force there, and she has stepped forward and represents a very powerful a segment of our population.
So
she's and of course her celebrity status gets her puts her in a position to assume that role.
Well, I
think it's ultimately a positive thing.
In her lifetime has taken lots of risks and done what other people would not have the courage to do.
Well, that's
yeah,
true. I mean, I can't question her sincerity.
There certainly are people who...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, there certainly are people who, with celebrity status, would not want to do anything to risk hurting that celebrity status. So, again, she has tremendous courage. And we need a dozen more, 100 more just like her.
Tell me how much time we have left.
Oh, we're looking at, I would love to close out with the full-length song today, and if we do that, we're looking at about 10 minutes.
Okay. Would you like to talk for about 10 minutes or so about this issue of the rise in superbugs and antibiotics? There was an article on Mercola.com.
Let's do that.
Okay, so I think this kind of plays into the vaccine issue, because the loss of control of curative action of antibiotics today, and he questions, asking, is the end of antibiotic era coming closer? And we have a list of about four different bacteria that are out there. Acinobacter, Bacteria found in the soil and water can often cause infections in seriously ill hospital patients. Anthrax, spread by infected animals or potentially bioterroristic weapons. Actually, there's about 12 of these bacteria. Group B, streptococcus, which is a common bacteria in newborns, the elderly, adults with other illnesses. Klebsiella pneumonia, a bacteria that leads to pneumonia and sepsis in the bloodstream, surgical wounds and things like that, and even meningitis. Methicillin-resistant staphylococcus aureus, which we call MRSA, MRSA. That superbug is really prevalent and is difficult to treat today, although we have some real-life stories of homeopathy curing that infection, and it can go into your bones, joints, bloodstream, heart valves, lungs, and also surgical wounds. Neisseria meningitis is also another bacteria in the young. Shigella is an infectious disease from that bacteria. Streptococcus pneumonia, which we see all the time, that can lead to sinusitis and acute otitis media. TB, tuberculosis, which is now, we have a very resistant form of that infection. Typhoid fever and vancomycin-resistant enterococci, VRE, is an infection with that bacteria, often incurred in hospitals, resistant to vancomycin and antibiotic. And lastly, vancomycin intermediate resistant staphylococcus aureus. So you can see that entire list of bacteria that have mutated and formed their own resistant forms. In this case, I would imagine that the medical community would be investigating vaccines as a preventative for all of these kinds of diseases, which are highly contagious, by the way. And so you can see the rise in our over-cleanliness, the use of the antibiotic-resistant hand-washing creams and gels and soaps, which actually cause these bacteria to mutate even more. So this is where I'm leading to superbugs and why the medical community is looking for a new era of vaccines. The last mention to this is if we would, again, optimize our diet, exercise, sleep, our relationship dynamics, emotional freedom therapy, stress reduction, and vitamin D, most especially, they have so much history showing that getting sunlight in wards and other hospital areas makes a big difference in raising our own immune-resistant capacity, not just the bacteria resistance to the antibiotic, but human resistance to infection. That's really where we want to lead the dynamics of medicine today, teaching people about creating a stronger body. Do you have any comments about that?
And then, Rich, feel free to, you know, take that question as being directed at both of us, but I'm going to jump in here with a comment. You know, we have this wide open door for industry to the vaccine industry because of there being virtually no liability for the manufacturers. The government subsidizes vaccine research and development. State and federal governments require vaccines and purchase vaccines, and the federal and sometimes state governments compensate the injuries. It's an all-profit and no-loss kind of scenario for the industry. I heard a figure earlier this year, there are 250 vaccines either already waiting for licensure by the FDA or in clinical trials where they'll be, you know, going through the final steps before licensure. There's just wide open door, you know, come and get the free candy for anybody who can manufacture vaccines and get them through the FDA's licensing procedure. And I only see what you're talking about, Debbie, as this growing risk and threat of disease from because of the waning effectiveness of antibiotics. All the more reason that some, I'm sure, would argue that we need more and more vaccines. It's just it's a very disturbing combination.
I think it's a move of desperation. I think it's a move of hopelessness and helplessness in terms of fighting disease. And this is the direction that they're putting all their eggs in one basket. Let's change DNA. Let's do some concoction in the lab with vaccines and inject the individual, and that's going to be the protection that we're going to provide.
Yeah.
I mean,
Rich, any thoughts there?
They could hand out jars of Manuka honey. They could provide tons and tons of garlic and make sure everybody has it. You know, subsidize garlic and olive leaf extract when you go to the store and really protect people.
Well, like I said earlier, as soon as you make that something that profits the pharmaceutical industry, they'll do it. And that I'm being facetious, but maybe that's part of our solution to transition to something that truly helps us. But, Rich, any comments there? We've got a couple of minutes left here.
Well, I do think that is a terrifying prospect, that the overuse of antibiotics, which they certainly have been overused for decades, and especially in children, that it's going to just cultivate all these superbugs. And I'm interested in agriculture, and we have the same exact problem with herbicides killing weeds, and what we're doing is just generating all these super weeds that no longer respond to the herbicides. And one kind of side comment on what you were talking about, Debbie, about vitamin D. We're learning more and more that vitamin D is critical in the body for the body to be healthy, and that we essentially get our vitamin D from the sunlight. And so think about, you know, in the last decades or a few years, there's this incredible push to get sunscreen on the children when they go out in the sun. It's as if God made a mistake putting the sun in the sky, and we all have to shield ourselves. Now, I'm not saying, you know, that we should be excessive and get sunburned, but it's like children don't even get into the sun anymore because their parents are so paranoid about that. Or if they do, they're lathered down with the sun. Has its own kind of side effects. And I might also mention the chemtrail kind of phenomena that is going on. We know that spraying barium and aluminum and heavy metals into the atmosphere, and there's not really an explanation for why, but it's been presumed that this is to offset global warming. But, you know, how about the prospect that this just blocks out the sun? And so it kind of makes us even more kind of lacking in our vitamin D. So it seems like a lot of these things can kind of fit together, you know, to make the people sick.
And, of course, let's not leave out the contribution that sunlight makes to our emotional well-being. You know, I was talking with an acquaintance recently and saying how glad I was to have as much wet weather this summer as we've had, because it's kept us cooler, abnormally cool, and I've had a lower electric bill for not having had to run the AC. And the response I got was, oh, but I've got to have the sun or I get depressed. And there are people who truly, some people are more sensitive to this or susceptible to this than others, but they need that sunlight to balance on a psychological or emotional level, as well as the physiological vitamin D aspect of it. So sunlight is not something we can just sort of take for granted and be happy that we don't have to use sunscreen if it rains, you know? Not
right.
That simple.
That's
we
right.
Do need sunscreen if it rains. Just because it's cloudy, those rays still get through.
Well, it's true that not quite as much, but the majority of it does still come through, and that's a really good point. A lot of people think if it's cloudy, they don't have to worry about getting sunburned, and you're absolutely right, Debbie. That's not true. It might take a little bit longer, but I think most of it still gets through. So excellent point,
umbrella.
Debbie, as always.
Carry an umbrella or wear a hat.
Could we say that a certain amount of sunlight each day would be healthy? Like, what is the cutoff? You know, I always feel like I could be in the sun, you know, moving around easily for an hour and come in, and that it would just be a very positive. It makes me look better, feel better. I don't sense that there's a danger. But at a certain point, certainly getting sunburned is a very unpleasant experience and not healthy. But, I mean, what is the kind of recommended dosage?
They actually have done some kinds of clinical trials. I don't have it at my fingertips, but how long a person can stay in the sun without feeling uncomfortable, moving, perspiring excessively, or getting burned. They have done trials, so we could look that up for another show.
Well, I expect
it's something that, you know, varies from person to person, latitude to latitude, time of year, situation, and so forth. But I've heard people recommend a minimum of 15 minutes a day of direct sun exposure to some part of your skin, you know, face and arms and legs, and maybe chest or back if you're able to expose more of your skin, depending on the situation. But some minimal daily exposure is something that I see a lot of doctors and others knowledgeable about vitamin D recommending, and I think it's a real good idea to do what you can. Most of us probably spend most of our time indoors at work or school or what have you. And so those people who don't, by virtue of their job or occupation, have regular sun exposure would certainly do well to make a point of incorporating that into their lives to whatever degree they reasonably can.
Yeah, so I think we're ready to listen to your song.
I wasn't going to cut you guys off to play the song. I decided to let it keep going. So now we're moving on to the 1 minute mark to do the 1 minute exit instead of the 4 minute exit. So I sort of made a decision on the fly there. So we've actually got about 55 seconds. If anybody wants to make any brief summarizing announcements, maybe just point out to folks that this is Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., and then ordinarily this last half hour, homeopathy with Debbie Brook from Homeopathy World Community. And we are here every Thursday afternoon by East Coast time, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., and then 10 a.m. to 12 noon Pacific time. And, Rich, it has been absolutely wonderful having you here. Thank you so much. Your comments have been very insightful, as always. We hope you'll come back again real soon. We try to have Rich on about once a month, so perhaps we'll see you back in a couple of weeks or so anyway. But thank you so much today for being here, because we didn't know whether or not Debbie was going to be able to make it. But, Debbie, awesome. You made it anyway. Terrific having you here. Pleasure as always.
Thank you. Don't forget to tune in on Monday, Nissan Communications, to the Health In Show. Gina Tyler is going to be talking about what she's seen as vaccine damage in Thailand with actual case studies.
All right, folks, we'll see you next week. Same time, Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. Thanks for being with us today.
Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul.
Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.